Hi there, it's Eliza D, host of the podcast How to Save the Planet. On my podcast, I interview people whose professions and whose passions have to do with climate change. Today, I'm talking to Sharon Duggan. To begin with, here's a little bit about Sharon. Sharon Duggan is a licensed attorney in California who, for decades, has successfully represented environmental advocacy groups through litigation to protect private forest lands and natural resources, resulting in numerous published state and federal court opinions. She is the co-author with Tara Mueller of Guide to the California Forest Practice Act and Related Laws, Regulation of Timber Harvesting on Private Lands in California, Solano Books Press, 2005. Sharon is also a co-founder and emeritus board member of Our Children's Trust, which is supporting youth in seeking a scientific-based solutions to the climate crisis through litigation and other actions to hold governments accountable for this and future generations. Now, please enjoy my interview with Sharon. Hello and welcome, Sharon, to How to Save the Planet. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Yes. So, what do you do and where do you work?
I am an attorney in California, in the Bay Area, and I do environmental law, public interest environmental law. I've been doing that for nearly 40 years. I'm actually coming towards the end of that as a formal professional work and retiring and doing other things. So,
nice.
But I did litigation for nearly 40 years, primarily trying to protect natural resources, particularly forests, fish, and wildlife, and water.
That's so very impressive.
Suing large corporations and state government, state and federal government.
Nice. What degrees do you have and where did you go to school?
Well, I went to college at USF, the University of San Francisco, and then I finished at San Francisco State University. It was at a time when the Vietnam War was winding down or in full thrust. And so I took a time off to do that. And then I later went to law school. So I have a JD from the University of Pacific, McGeorge School of Law in Sacramento.
Cool. What got you interested in environmental law and why did you choose to spend 40 years doing it?
You know, I think it is really because of, you know, love of the earth and love of the environment. I had the good fortune, in my opinion anyway, of, I was born in San Francisco, California, as a third generation San Franciscan, and was largely raised in Northern California in Humboldt County. And I always felt like I had the best of both worlds. And in Humboldt, I, you know, I certainly experienced a lot of beautiful nature, particularly in the 50s and 60s. And when I was in, I didn't know actually when I went to law school that I wanted to do environmental law, but I was involved in some efforts to save an area or to try and make it part of a protected area called the Sinkion, which is in the Lost Coast region of California. So it's the part of California that is north of, generally north of Ukiah, up to Eureka, where there's no freeway that goes right along the coast. But, you know, California's famous in some respects for its beautiful coastal scenery, and but there's no freeway in that part. And so that part in the north, they call it the Lost Coast because there's no real easy access. And it is, the Sinkion is an area where the Sinkion Indians, you know, it's their place of heritage and cultural experiences and gatherings over the years. And so I got involved in that, and that's what led me to my very first environmental law case when I came out of law school almost immediately. And I had the good fortune of working in a very small firm where there was a real dedication to trying to do some environmental work and policy work. So that's how I got involved, really. It was during law school and then after law school.
Cool. I can imagine that going up against these big companies and systems can be really, exhausting. I'm sure being a lawyer is just like exhausting in general, but what keeps you going?
Well, you know, I think that certainly when I was a younger lawyer, and throughout, you know, it really is like a David and Goliath kind of scenario in those days. And particularly, I think in the early 80s, environmental law per se wasn't all that popular, and there was just a handful of people doing public interest work. And so it was, you know, and we really were up against a lot of significant resources, both in terms of state and federal government and the attorneys that they would bring in, as well as the corporations, you know, particularly timber companies. And so I think that, you know, from my perspective, I guess I would say that as time went on, it became clear to me, and I'll paraphrase here. I don't know if you've ever heard of Václav Havel, who was at one time the president of Czechoslovakia and the Czech Republic. And he was, you know, a pretty radical guy in his own right. And he had a statement that to the effect that hope is not that something will turn out a particular way, but that something must be done regardless of how it turns out. And obviously, you know, I was somebody who really believed in everything we did and our efforts, particularly to save old growth redwoods and those kinds of things. And but I also knew that we were up against such difficult challenges that we might not always win, but we still had to do it because it was right. So I think that's part of it is that, you know, what kept me going and has kept me going for so many years is just really the belief in, you know, what is right and what is needed. And as time has passed now, certainly we've gotten to a point now where if ever there was a time for dedicated action and effort, you know, because of the climate crisis, it's now. So I think it's fundamentally that belief that, you know, we must do what we must do, not necessarily believe that it's going to come out as we want it, but that it has to be done because we have to do our best to protect and preserve and conserve, and we have to do our best to educate. So it's a responsibility, I think, too.
What is one thing listeners can do to help stop the climate crisis or to help lower their carbon footprint, do you think?
Oh, you know, I don't, I'm not sure that there's any one thing, to be honest with you, at this point. You know, the more I read, and every day, you know, the more experience we have with the effects of the climate crisis, it's clear to me that we need systemic change, that everyone's effort to, you know, not create such a large carbon footprint. I mean, you know, and it's any number of things. I mean, stop buying so much for starters, right? Stop using cars as much as we do. Stop using plastic, which is an oil product. You know, I mean, there's just so many different ways that we can intersect in our own personal lives. But all of those things together are probably not what's going to help us move through this at this point. I mean, if we don't get effective systemic change, you know, now. So, you know, so I was thinking actually one thing that and this is more of a community kind of thing, but one thing that I thought of is what if all of us, over the course of a dedicated period of time, were to overload Biden's email address at the White House. All of us, I mean, you know, millions of people. Because, you know, he talks the talk, but I don't see him walking the walk. I just, you know, and, you know, with all due respect, he's an elderly gentleman who wants everybody to kind of get along, and we're not there. You know, this is not a neat little package anymore. And so I thought, you know, you think about people having the million person march and all of those things are good because it's good for people to come together. But what's the way that all of us can just take a stand? Because I mean, gee, we're losing traction as every day goes by. And every day we know we don't have much time. So anyway, so I mean, I think everybody has to take personal responsibility to reduce their footprint in any number of ways. I mean, it's their energy use, it's their fossil fuel use, It's all the things that are attached to that. It's you know, their consumption, all of those kinds of things. And at the same time, you know, we all have to be involved in systemic change.
Yeah. Contacting legislators and like Biden, for example.
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, the reason I say Biden is because, you know, he's out there. I mean, I was thinking, for example, this whole idea that, you know, we want to negotiate with China over their torture. And so, you know, and China says, you know, we're not going to do anything good on climate unless you let us continue our torture. And, you know, after what just happened in Afghanistan, it seems to me that maybe we are not the world's police person that we think we are, because we certainly don't have the moral stature. And so maybe what we should be doing is taking care of what we're supposed to be doing on climate before we're asked, demanding something of another country, because our country is not, you know, we're really not doing what we need to do. And it's kind of a lot of hubris to expect another country to do something when we're not really willing to be held accountable. And in that way, then we don't put ourselves in this dichotomy where we have to agree to let China continue to torture. You know, we do our part, and then, you know, and then we're free to say to China, you need to do your part, and we don't have to have the question of human rights be the negotiation point, you know, because they go together. They go together. So, but we need here in our country, we really do need to take it seriously. And I don't think we are. I don't think on a fundamental basic level that our leaders, our elected officials, I don't think they appreciate that this is not something that's a neat little bundle. It's not something that can be done through committees and legislation that takes forever. That's not where we are. We've got to stop the fossil fuel nip. You know, we have to stop it. It's got it. We have to. And unfortunately, because we have waited and waited and waited, now it's radical. It's radical.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What is the most memorable experience you think you've had that's like shaped you today, as an environmental lawyer or as someone who cares about the environment a lot?
You know, I that's a hard one to answer, because I feel like I've had, you know, I've had some remarkable experiences in my life. I feel that way. You know, as a young person, just being able to be in glorious nature that was in those, you know, I can remember seeing wild horses in Humboldt County and how exciting that was. And so there's something about that enlivening spirit that comes. And I've had such remarkable friendships and relationships. I certainly know, you know, I had a very brief, a little over a year period of time in a Catholic Cistercian monastery, women's community in Southern Humboldt, Our Lady of the Redwoods. And it definitely had a profound effect on me. And that is because, you know, in my way of saying it, which is not to say that they necessarily would say it quite so simply, I guess, you know, that path, that monastic path, is really one of self-knowledge and trying to understand yourself and know yourself, because that is indeed what, to the extent there is a God and there is a presence of something greater than ourselves, what the relationship that's asked is that we become who we are, uniquely who we are. And so from that perspective, I would say Redwoods had that profound effect on me, because to this day, I really believe that we each have that responsibility to know ourselves, to continue to know ourselves. And as we know ourselves, we find our uniqueness of what is the gift, and, you know, that we can bring to the larger world and to our families, our friends, you know, our loved ones, our communities, etc. So I'd say, I mean, Redwoods would be one. I don't think it's the only one, but I think it would be one that really informed me and certainly led me into that understanding of how to become myself is what led me to law school.
I can imagine that, like, being in like I what I think is like a somewhat male-dominated field, that your experience has been definitely unique. Can you say a bit about that, being a female attorney?
When I became a lawyer, definitely women were not, we were the minority. I certainly think that's gotten better. I also feel, and this is a feeling, experientially, that the court system continues to have a real preference for the male model, if you will. And so a lot of women successfully adapt themselves in different ways and are able to negotiate that. And I think a lot of us, as we go on, we certainly hold our own voice as we can. But I am definitely one of those, I came out of law school in 1982, became a lawyer, and I can tell you that, in those early days in particular, I absolutely, I remember a judge who would just look down at my shoes to make sure that my shoes were the appropriate kind and that they were clean enough, and being referred to as not as, Miss Duggan, but as something more common in terms of, ma'am, or now listen, lady, those kinds of things. And frankly, you get tired of it. And I will say that even up until this time, I've gotten tired of it. And it's not just judges and court systems, but it's opposing counsel, and it's, dealing with attorneys who always are looking for a way to get the better of you. And when you get into litigation, and when you get into litigation where I mean, we weren't suing for money ever. It wasn't ever about money. It was about resources. But to those interests on the other side, it was always about money, right? I mean, if they wanted to cut all the redwood, old growth redwood, that was a lot of money. And so they would pull whatever punches they could. I had one attorney who, for years, he always consciously mispronounced my name. Always. I mean, it was very clear to me that that was intentional. And I would correct him in front of the court, and most often the judges were appreciative of that. Some, failed to take notice, but it's I think, I think law in and of itself is a is a is a what I say, it's very challenging in a lot of ways, and there's a lot of gamesmanship that seems to gotten worse, in my opinion. Just my opinion, but
Yeah, I can't imagine how much like perseverance and like determination you've had over your career, like dealing with like so many obstacles.
well, yeah, I mean, I think that it's, of course, and I chose it what is really not the traditional route. I mean, for the most part, except for those first early years in that small firm, I was a solo practitioner, and and I didn't have a big firm, and I didn't have a lot of staff, and I worked on my own, and I didn't make a lot of money, because oftentimes, well, all of the time, I either took cases entirely pro bono or with a very reduced hourly rate. And because I was working with public interest groups that couldn't afford to hire attorneys at, significant hourly rates or anything like that. And so I was well known for being able to stay up all night, many nights in the early days, to try and stop, the cutting of the trees. And all of that takes a toll. And the truth is that I learned a lot that other lawyers never learn. I mean, I learned some of the fundamentals just about how you get things done. And I feel like it was valuable. But it's hard when you make that kind of choice. And I have colleagues who've done that as well, who have decided to really do the public interest route. And it's not easy. I mean, the reward, of course, is that we have, particularly when we succeed, we've done something good. We know that we've done something good. We've acted in the good.
If you're willing to share it, what are some of the things you've learned? doing what you do?
One thing I've learned is patience, let's say. Another thing I've learned is to be able to listen. And to really be able to take the time to look at things. I think I've learned more, in retrospect than in actuality, that it's really important to balance one's work with everything else. Edward Abbey has that famous admonition that you should spend as much time out in nature as you are sitting behind a desk trying to save nature. And I can tell you honestly, I did not do that. I spent a lot of time behind the desk. And I don't regret that, but I'm grateful that I had opportunities to be in nature when I really needed to. So I think one of the things I learned is that, an intentional love, if you will, for our earth and our world.
I guess I should ask this question at the beginning, but if listeners don't know what an attorney does or what an environmental lawyer does, could you explain what like a day in the life of yours would look like?
Sure. I mean, it's different for everybody, but in my world, I generally represent small nonprofit groups. I think the largest group I've ever represented is the Sierra Club, which isn't small, of course, but it has chapters. And so that makes it a little more manageable. And I typically work very closely with them in that they will come to me with an issue. The one that has been most frequent in my life, of course, has been logging, both on federal land and on private land under California's laws. And we would work, we would work through what needed to be done. And generally, most often, that would mean that we had to start in an administrative process with a government agency, and we'd have to review sometimes, reams of paper to identify what needed to be done and to apply that to the law so that we would know what could be done, and then a lawsuit gets filed. And then, it really is a matter of doing a lot of research, a lot of legal writing, and a lot of review of documents, and then ultimately, going in court and arguing a case to the court and generally dealing with attorneys from the other side who, again, like I said earlier, are either big law firms that represent large corporations, well-funded private entities, if you will, as well as either, the California State Attorney General's office or the Department of Justice, the federal government, dealing with those kinds of attorneys who, most often I would say would try to make us, myself and my clients, make us out to be, just naysayers and trying to stop progress or trying to hurt the economy or taking away jobs or anything like that. And then ultimately they would, if we would prevail and we would seek attorney's fees under the private attorney general statutes, they would accuse us of, really just doing this for money and never appreciating that, you can go for years literally without making money. Whereas they are always well paid, well protected, with all the benefits. And so I think that's, one of the things that, that pains me, honestly, because I always want the public attorneys to act in the public interest, and I feel like oftentimes they act in the private interests of their applicants or their own budgets, and not looking at a greater good. So,
yeah.
So I don't know if that tells you, if that gives you a sense, but basically it's a lot of desk work. It's a lot of, you know, and as time has gone on, because when I started, you know, we didn't really have computers, and you wrote briefs on typewriters with carbon copy paper, and which is a very different world, you know, but gradually over time, we have computers and we spend a lot of time at the desk and we review a lot of things. And almost always there is an opportunity, if you can't go out into the field because it's a private property, you at least can be with the clients in a way, in an environment that helps you appreciate what it's all about. So,
yeah. Why did you co-found Our Children's Trust?
So Julia Olson, who is the executive director and, you know, the insight founder, if you will, of Our Children's Trust, she and I have been colleagues, and we have been working together, for maybe about 10 years, something like that, on various kinds of litigation, notably the Yosemite stuff involving the Merced River in the park itself. And Julia, you know, Julia really wanted to do something about climate change because, you know, she was having children. And she knew that if she was going to have children, she needed to find a way to make the world better for them. And so I would say that the reason why I helped to create Our Children's Trust was because of relationship and because of young people just like yourself, the awareness that, you know, things were not being attended to, and we really had to find a way to support young people in an effort to try and put a beam of light, shine light on the need for action in a very credible way. And because of, you know, close relationship with people who care, like Julia.
Yeah. What does climate justice mean to you and your work?
I don't know that we can effectively deal with climate change and the crisis that we've created without dealing with climate justice. And for me, what that means is that those countries and people who have more are more responsible for the crisis that has been created, and that they're around the world, as well as in our own communities, there are people who are experiencing a disproportionate impact from the climate crisis. I mean, and you can look in certain poor areas, certainly in the southern part of our country. You can look in our poor neighborhoods in Oakland. As our environment gets degraded, the poor communities suffer more. And so climate justice requires that we have to alter that disproportionality, and we have to bring things into balance. I don't know that we can effectively deal with the climate crisis if we don't deal with social justice. It's a justice issue, and it's an equity issue. And I think that we owe it, when I say we, now I'm speaking of the United States, you know, we have an obligation and a responsibility to the rest of the world. And not only are we not attending to things here in our own country, but we're not fulfilling our responsibility to those places around the world, which we have allowed to be degraded and polluted. And we've taken their resources, and we continue to take their resources, and we let our corporations take their resources. And that's, you know, for climate justice, we have to shift the manner in which we conduct our affairs.
Mm-hmm.
to provide not only to provide equality, but to bring everybody to a same level. And it doesn't mean necessarily everybody has to be all industrialized. It doesn't mean that everybody has to be like the Western world. What it does mean is that everybody has to be protected so that they can have a full life that is healthy and with liberty and clean water and clean air and the ability to have quality lifestyle in their own culture. It's got to be with respect to their own culture.
Yeah. Well, those are all of the questions that I have. Do you have any other things to say or extra comments?
Well, I guess, you know, I feel increasingly so. I've heard Biden recently speak about, I've heard him say this more than once. He'll say, when I think of climate change, I think of jobs, you know? And that really makes me cringe because I feel like that's the same thing I've heard most of my attorney life, which is jobs versus the economy, you know? Mm-hmm. Jobs versus the environment, or the economy versus the environment. And invariably, you know, governments and courts they side with the economy, they side with jobs, you know? And to me, that is just so fundamentally wrong. And it really candidly makes me angry at Biden that he doesn't appreciate what he's saying. Because climate change is not about jobs. I mean, if you think that that's your little road out, you're really missing the boat here, because it's one thing that can be done, but we cannot focus our efforts on jobs because we have 9 years, right? We have till 2030. That's what the IPCC says.
Mm-hmm.
When you watch the news and they'll say, you know, the projection is that by, you know, the end of the century, by 20, you know, we're going to have whatever the elevation and temperature is going to be, or the sea level rise or anything like that. And I just feel like, again, what that does is it gives everybody the ability to sit back and say, I guess we don't really have to worry about it. We still have, you know, a lot of time. Somebody will figure this out, just like, you know, they'll figure out to keep smoking, because that's what Paul Hawkins says, you know, keep smoking because someday somebody will come up with a cure for cancer. I mean, that's an example that he uses. And it's this sense that, you know, we need so to understand that we're really at a point of no return here, because 9 years is a blink of an eye. I mean, it's so short. And if all we're going to do is have committees and legislation and this and that and go around the world and talk to people, we already know we're seeing that with this Paris Agreement, which in and of itself wasn't that strong. And so, my sense of urgency is that I do really feel that we all have to do what we can do personally, but that's not enough. It is just not enough. We really have to, you know, make our leaders accountable. You know, I think about Biden, and I think if he were to get, he should understand that he's going to be president until 2025. If we don't take care of this by then, he's going to be responsible.
Mm-hmm.
We'll have to be held accountable. His presidency will be a failure, plain and simple. Yeah. It's totally separate from everything else. And the same may be said for every governor in this state, every leader, you know, and they need to, we need to make this real. People need to feel it. They really need to kind of feel it in their bones and in their lives. Because if they think it's something that's just, as, you know, something you can talk about and it's not, everything's going to be okay, it'll work its way out, that's not what's going to happen. I think all of the science tells us that that's not what's going to happen. And let me just say, Eliza, because I know that, you know, it's not fair. It's not fair to you. And what I want more than anything is for us to find a way to be together, us being, you know, those of us with the gray hair and the white hair and those young people like yourself. How are we together in a way that we give you hope for the future, you know, for a world that is going to be what you want. How we have to work, we have to be together, and you have to give us your leadership and your vibrancy and your insight, and we have to give you our time and our effort and our resources so that we can walk together to get to move this, because, you know, it's what we need. So
yeah, anyway. Thank you. Yeah. Thank you so much for coming on How to Save the Planet. I so appreciate your time and your wisdom. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Eliza. And I, you know, I wish you the very best in everything you do.
Well, that is it for this episode. Thank you so much for listening. And if you haven't already, subscribe to How to Save the Planet so you don't miss any new episodes. See you next time.